Welcome to the second session on faith in science and education. We've got three good talks to listen to. Our first speaker is going to be George Murphy, who will be talking about teaching faith and science without losing souls.
Thank you. Great. Okay, I'm missing a page here. Okay, well, no, here we go. I'm going to be informal and base this talk on my own teaching experience in the area of faith and science. One reason I began formal theological study in the first place is a feeling that faith and science was a very important issue that the church needed to deal with, and that it wasn't doing a very good job dealing with that, and that was certainly true back in the 1970s. For nearly 40 years now, I have been teaching youth and adults in congregations, been teaching seminary courses, workshops for clergy and laity in various settings. And a couple of my books have been specifically intended for adult education in the church. The reason I wear the green clerical shirt today is one that actually originally was for St. Patrick's Day, but I do that when I'm teaching something about environmental science, environmental theology. The point of my title, and I borrowed the structure of that from a thesis of Luther's, is that teaching about faith and science should be done from the standpoint of Christian faith. If we do that, then it is fairly straightforward to connect that with science as the study of God's creation. But if we simply start from science, there is no way really to reach, in a natural way, to reach the distinctively Christian faith. And distinctively is an important word there. Christianity is not simply generic theism. Now, teaching it in that way is not going to be a problem if you're dealing with Christians in congregations and so forth. However, it's also not a problem if non-Christians happen to be present. Even though the purpose of what I'm saying is not really apologetics, I think that the best apologetic is good theology, to bring people into the context of an understanding of the Christian faith. Now, this paper is in the teaching faith and science category for this conference. We can assume the broad definition of science there that is used in the statement of criteria for membership of the ASA. However, the word theology would really be better than the word faith, because theology is faith in search of understanding, and it's our understanding of the faith that engages with science. Now, I know for some people, theology is a scary-sounding word because it suggests a kind of arcane academic discipline. In one discussion about an educational program, I used the word theology, and I was asked, can't we find a more user-friendly word than theology? Well, I think we need to make theology user-friendly because we need to encourage Christians to think about their faith. And the way we understand our faith is what, as I said, science engages with. Jesus, after all, said that loving God with all your mind is part of the greatest commandment. And my pages have gotten, here we go. Now, of course, you don't have to be a professional theologian to teach faith and science. But if you're not interested in thinking about your faith, you really shouldn't be teaching anything in the church at all. Now, when we speak about theology and science, that really includes the discussion of the applied sciences, technology, and includes ethics as well. So it is actually a four-way conversation. And there are all kinds of courses, classes, and so forth that you could deal with in this area, either a broad survey or specific areas about environmental theology, biomedical ethics, and so forth. And what I'm going to say is going to mostly apply to all of that. Now, I spoke about good theology. What distinguishes good theology from bad theology? To oversimplify considerably, good theology is theology based on the biblical witness to Jesus Christ. He is the interpretive center of Scripture. Simply starting from the Bible does not ensure good theology. At my early first ASA meeting, almost 40 years ago, there was a young earth creationist speaking who is a scientist, and I asked him how he could square his science, his belief in six-day creation with his scientific understanding of data and about the world. And his response was, when I get a new piece of equipment that I don't understand something about, I read the specs manual. The Bible is the specs manual for the earth. Now, that is ensured to result in some distorted theology. Just as reading the Bible as a way to figure out when the end of the world is going to happen, or any other way than first and foremost a witness to what God has done and will do in Jesus Christ. Furthermore, if we simply start from the Bible, most Christians are going to immediately turn to Genesis 1 and 2 to talk about creation. And of course, those texts are very important. They need to be dealt with. We'd be better off if we would start with texts like the Christ hymn of Colossians or the prologue of the Gospel of John. And those tell us that Christ is the one by whom and for whom and in whom all things are created. In the Gospels, Jesus gives more attention to what God is doing in the world today than to what happened back in the beginning. My Father is working even until now, and I am working, he said. Now, so you begin your teaching from the standpoint of good theology. And in that context, you ought to present the best science that is available. To say that we ought to begin from a Christian standpoint does not mean that standpoint that the Bible or church doctrine determines the science that we should teach. The science that ought to be presented is science that atheists, Jews, Muslims, everybody else can do as well as Christians. There is no distinctively Christian science. It's an attempt to understand the world that can be pursued by people of any religious faith or no religious faith at all. And that empirical fact makes theological sense. God's signature saving work, the salvation of the world in Jesus Christ, does not look, by dying on the cross and rising again, does not look anything like what we expect God to be. He had no beauty that we should desire him. The scientists Blaise Pascal and the cosmologist Georges Lemaître, as well as Martin Luther, quoted in critical places the verse from Isaiah 45, 15, "Truly you are a God who hides himself, O God of Israel, the Savior." And Pascal's statement about that is particularly significant. He said, "What meets our eyes in the world denotes neither a total absence nor a manifest presence of the divine, but the presence of a God who conceals himself. Everything bears this stamp." So the fact that scientists don't need to invoke God in order to understand the world is not something that simply has to be admitted grudgingly by Christians. It is a fundamental aspect of the way God works in the world. God acts in that hidden, concealed way. And that ought to be understood as an expression of God's grace and beneficence, because it gives us the opportunity to understand the world by ourselves, by the use of our own brains. The creatures of the world are not simply an extension of God or puppets that God moves around. Now, talking about Christians about relationships between faith and science needs to be done in ways that are age appropriate, of course, and appropriate to the educational levels of the people you're dealing with. Now, I have in mind here what I have often been involved with is dealing with intelligent adults who don't have any special understanding of either the sciences or of theology. So appropriate modifications can be made where necessary. Now, note that I use the word learners rather than students. It's not a critical point, but with adults and to some extent with younger people, it's better to think of yourself and the people that you're dealing with as participants in a process rather than people that you're simply going to download some information into. And related to that is the word that's often used, workshop. We're going to have a workshop on something. And as one adult education expert commented, a lot of workshops are in reality what he called sponge shops. That is where the people are supposed to come and soak up the wisdom that you're going to pour into them. Workshops should be really workshops. The learners should be encouraged to be participating and make their own contributions. Now, especially with a group of learners in which you may be wanting to deal with some potentially controversial issues, I think it is best not to start with something like creation and evolution. For an adult class or a forum that's going to talk about a range of issues, a kind of general survey, I would suggest beginning with the three following questions and brief responses. First, how can we know about the world? The answer would review the so-called scientific method without any implication that it is a standardized cookbook-like procedure. It's basically observation plus reason in any order, with observation having the last word. Second, how can we know about God? And there the views of Christians will vary with mixes of special revelation and general revelation. Special revelation ought to have priority because that's what makes we're talking about is distinctively Christian understanding. To the question of whether or not science can tell us anything about God, my answer would be yes, it can, but only if it is in that Christian context. And thirdly, how does God act in the world? Thirdly, how does God act in the world? And here there are a lot of different models of God's action. This is an important issue because it is really an introduction to the doctrine of creation. And I think the best approach is the one that I discussed in an article in Perspectives on Christian Science and Christian Faith earlier this year. That is the traditional approach in which we speak about God cooperating with creatures in their actions. So both God and creatures act together with God as the final cause of what they do. And starting with God's creative action in the world that way is a good corrective to the idea that creation has to do fundamentally within the beginning. But we can talk about how God acts in the world and use various models. Ian Barber outlined 10 of those, but I suggested the one that we is maybe the simplest one to use. And once we do that, and once we talk about the way God acts in the world today, we can then do what science does by extrapolating our understanding of the world today back in time to the origin of the world. And we can do the same thing with our theology and extrapolate our understanding of God's action in the world back in time. And in fact, we can go back to within a fraction of a second of the beginning of the Big Bang. Beyond that, obviously, we involve some speculation. You also want to discuss at some point, of course, biological evolution. And you want to discuss the basic history, Darwin's work, the evidence that supports evolution, common descent, modern genetic contributions, and other things. The thing that's going to be a critical issue for a lot of people is the whole issue of suffering, death, and so forth involved in natural selection. How can a good God work this way to create life? And that's the issue of theodicy, a very traditional question. And I have made my own responses to that. I've written things about that. And however, I would not claim that I don't think I or anybody else can sort of give a neat solution to that problem. What I would say is you should not let that question drive your theology, determine the kind of theology that you're going to do to try to deal with that sort of objection that is often presented by atheists. when you start talking about going back in time toward the beginning, of course, there you need to deal with the Genesis texts. I don't have time to go into the all the details of how you might want to go about doing that. However, there are some things that I would suggest. You want to, of course, do your own work on Genesis and get your own understanding of how to approach that. The one thing that I would say is that a concordist approach to the Genesis texts of creation should not be encouraged. They are not simply simplified versions of what we have in modern astrophysics, geophysics, paleontology, and so forth. They are theological texts that make important and for Christians authoritative theological claims. God is the sole creator of the universe. Creation is good. Humans are given a special role in creation in the world, given special responsibilities, special place. However, in doing that, it makes use of what Dennis Lamoureux discusses as the ancient science of the Bible. That is the picture of the world in the ancient, that the people in the ancient Near East had, which we understand now is outdated. Now, in saying that concordism should not be encouraged, there are times when you can be a little bit loose with that. I had an experience recently of a man who's an engineer, came from a conservative Christian background, and he was talking to me, found out my interest in this area, and said, "You know, I've been thinking recently," he said, "maybe the days of creation are all like millions of years long." Now, I could have said, you know, people have thought of that, though, for hundreds of years, and it doesn't work for a lot of reasons. But, you know, you got to take it easy sometimes. And that's okay as a halfway house for somebody a few days ago was a young Earth creationist. So, yeah, okay, that's a way you can think about it. You know, he's going to continue to change, we hope. Now, it's important to talk about good science. But it is not feasible sometimes, as with modern quantum mechanics or molecular genetics, it is not feasible really to go into any great detail on those things, especially with students who don't really have, or learners who don't have a lot of mathematics. And it's nice if you can give a taste of something more, but often that's hard. Now, consider the question, which may come up, the whole question of the age of the Earth. Some people may not be young Earth creationists, but how do we really know the age of the Earth? And it's not completely satisfactory to just do hand-waving and say, well, radioactive dating. On the other hand, actually going into the details of how radioactive dating of the Earth is done can get a little bit complicated. However, we can get a rough estimate for a related age, that of the material of the solar system. Point out that something they may know of from newspaper reports about nuclear weapons and so forth, that there are two isotopes of uranium, the kind you can make bombs out of and the kind you can't make bombs out of. Okay, the first one has a half-life of about 700 million years. The second one has a half-life about 7.5 times that, of 4.5 billion years. And a natural question might occur, why is there much less of the bomb-type material, if you don't mind my using that terminology? Okay, well, a thing that naturally suggests itself, maybe to begin with, they were roughly equal, and the reason there's less of it is because it decays faster. Well, you can work this out fairly simply. Okay, how many half-lives of the bomb-type material would it take to get to approximately that of the other isotope? Well, work it out. It's a factor of, and also, I should have said, we know what the proportions of those two isotopes are now. There's only one atom of the bomb-type material to 138 of the other. Well, if you take how many half-lives of the first type do you need, fairly simple to work out. 1/2 to the 7th power is 1 over 128, which is roughly 1 over 138. So roughly 7 half-lives of U-235, which works out to about 5 billion years. Now, that's a very rough estimate. There are obviously all kinds of corrections that need to be made. But it is an estimate that is in the correct ballpark. And it gives you an answer of billions of years rather than thousands of years. And if somebody tries to pull a parent age argument, you can talk to them about the interesting natural reactors in West Africa and Oklo, but that gets more technical. Well, I'm running out of time here, and I wanted to talk about using case studies in teaching, and this is, I think, can be a very helpful thing. I often did that in seminary because it's helping to prepare people who are going to become pastors for some of the issues that they might confront and some of the issues that I myself confronted in parish ministry. And so we could spend more time on that. And there are, of course, other approaches to teaching faith and science that I have not talked about here. I've just talked about the way that I've generally gone about doing this, and you'll hear other talks today. I will simply conclude by re-emphasizing my two basic points about teaching in this area, that you need to start from a good Christian standpoint, not simply belief in God, but belief in the God who is revealed to us in Jesus Christ, and put the best science that is available in that context. I'll end with, I'll note also that there are certainly references, there are books available, and more things are being written that are useful educational resources for this kind of thing. I'll just mention two of them. My own book, Toward a Christian View of a Scientific World, which is a kind of general survey that's intended for adult learners in congregations. And I just got something from Jim Miller, from the Presbyterian Science and Faith Group that he sent me, Where Did I Come From? It's intended for parents of children, but obviously it would be useful for teachers for children. And I think I haven't had an opportunity to read it yet. I just got it the day before we left, but looks as though it might be helpful. But there are other things, and some of them are on the book table.
Time for questions. Any questions?
Yes,
Kevin. One thing, I resonate very much with your approach. Another additional thing that I found helpful is incorporating the history of science. Incorporating the history of science. In talking about how those initial discoveries were made, because obviously there had to be a process by which people came to that understanding. And I found that sometimes helpful at putting it in a historical context rather than just this is the way it is. I found that a useful approach.
Yeah, that certainly including that. As I said, I mean, you want to talk about Darwin, and I always include Wallace as well. Yeah. And if you're talking about going back in time and how the Big Bang was found and so forth, you'll talk about the various historical events that occurred there. But generally, I have not, in my seminary courses, I did a sort of brief historical coverage first, but generally I don't do that, but include the historical part sort of as you go along.
The ASA table, there's a free booklet of chemistry professor at Harvey Mudd that they're for as a guideline for a series of 12 discussions about this sort of topic. Have you taken a look at that?
I haven't looked at that particularly. No, I know there are a lot of things that are now being produced, and that's fairly recent. It's most of the time, much of what is done in the whole so-called religion science area is more academic things than directed toward educational usage. Excuse me. Yes, Mark.
What would be the settings in which, in the local church now, that we do this type of education primarily? What are the best contexts?
Well, what I've done, in churches where I have been on staff, or where I've been the sole pastor, I've been involved a lot in the adult education, and I will do other various topics. I don't do not just faith and science, but I do that occasionally, talk about that, in general gives an interest. Sometimes when I do supply preaching, which I do fairly frequently now, I will tell the pastor, if people are interested, I could also do a session on
religion and science, theology and science, and several times have done that. And again, people are usually interested in that. But that's usually a one-shot thing, so you do somewhat limited. Glad to talk. I think my time's up.
Okay. Well, thank you again.